Hello, this is your host, David Starr. Welcome to this momentous episode of the Pluralcast. This episode of the Pluralcast just so happens to be my last as host. Now, this show may very well continue with another host, but as far as I know, that decision's not yet been made. You can voice your opinion on that subject by sending email to cast@pluralsight.com. Now, today's episode is actually a discussion with Jeffrey Palermo, Chief Operating Officer of Headspring in Austin, Texas. Headspring is a software consultation firm. His career is the subject of our discussion, how he got where he is, the sorts of things that he has found valuable in his career, and how he currently manages his organization. Some of the important parts of his life as COO of Headspring. This is indeed the last Pluralcast with me as a host, and I'd like to explain a little bit about that. My relationship with Pluralsight remains really strong, by the way, but also remains that of a contractor. I've always had a contracting relationship with Pluralsight, as do most of us instructors, and we love teaching and recording content on the .NET stack, on software development in general, and this will continue for me. I still look forward to producing online content for Pluralsight. So nothing changes there. What does change is that I took a job, a full-time job, working for the man, and that will start here in the next couple of weeks. I just got my new business cards in, and my title is apparently Chief Craftsman for Scrum.org. So I'm going to go work further the mission of improving the profession of software development with Scrum.org. And as such, I'm just not going to have the time to keep producing the Pluralcast. I have had an absolute ball having the discussions that I have had with developers in the .NET stack and being able to talk to you, the listeners of the show. Now keep the URL registered in your aggregator because you just may find new episodes popping up with a new host, but I'll make no promises about that. Well, all right, folks, let's get on to our conversation with Jeffrey Palermo.
When I was 16, I purchased my first computer, and I borrowed some money from my grandmother, and then my working a summer job at Taco Bell, I basically made the money to pay her back, but I bought a fairly expensive computer at the time, and it was just when 486s were mainstream and 14.4 modems were around. I got a blazing fast Pentium 1.
Yeah.
Anyway, I created a Yahoo account before Yahoo offered email. They offered a few other services, and so there were some other service providers that were early in the World Wide Web. AOL was huge. And I started programming by creating a web page. And I was one of the early people who had an email address when if you ask someone, hey, what's your email? They ask, what's that? And so I got started with programming just by cutting and paste little snippets of HTML that I found to make myself one of the flashiest, blinkiest, animated GIF-laden web page you ever saw, and put some interesting JavaScript, and I absolutely had a hit counter, and I would check that hit counter every day to see the three people who had accidentally stumbled on my site before making it to where they actually wanted to go.
That's awesome. I think a lot of us got started that way, at least with the web. So this is interesting to me because you're one of the few folks I've ever spoken to who their very first introduction to programming was on the web.
You know, I can't say that definitively because I did do a little bit of basic A with IBM compatible around when I was 12 or so, but I didn't really consider that programming. That was just a basic, who are you prompt. And if it was any of my brothers who put in their name, it would just say, you suck. But if I put in my name, the program told me, you're cool. And that was it. That was the extent of the program. And I didn't really consider that programming. It was just playing around with the computer.
That is, though, the classic story of how most of us get started, or got started. You know, you go to Sears, they have all the computers out, and you type in, you know, Dave Star rocks, go to 10, return.
Right.
And confuse the sales guy.
That's right.
Okay, but the first real programming you did sounds like was focused on the web. And at that point, you say you're 16, 17 years old, right around in that area.
Right. And so I played around with that. In my high school, in retrospect, they did offer a computer science class that taught Pascal. And unfortunately, I didn't take it. In hindsight, I wish I would have. But the school district actually hired me as a computer programmer about 3 days after high school graduation. And that was my summer job between high school and college. And it wasn't an internship. It wasn't a volunteer. They hired me as a programmer, a little bit over minimum wage, mind you. But I had my first job as a programmer immediately after high school graduation, and I started building business systems for them. It was Internet Explorer 3, Netscape 3, and it was Internet Database Connector technology called IDC with HTX templates.
Well, I'm curious, that summer that you spent programming for money right before you went into college, did you already see software development as a career path for you, or were you still just kind of finding your way?
I was still finding my way. It was very much just a very interesting summer job.
At what point did you start to think to yourself, you know, I like this. I like this enough that I could see myself doing it.
That was probably between my freshman and sophomore year. I basically took my credits from the engineering college into the business college, and they had just sort of switched from a major called business analysis, which was the business programmer curriculum, and changed it to MIS. Some schools call it CIS. I have a business degree with a focus on information systems for businesses. And so you could say that I'm not really qualified to work at Intel as a chip designer. I would never refute that. Or, you know, network protocols or any of the really nitty-gritty circuit board or, you know, real computer engineering or computer science focuses. But I decided, in no small part to the experience at the school district, that I really enjoyed working with computerized business systems that would help people get their job done, that would really impact people's lives and help businesses manage data and ultimately get work done more effectively. Because I could see that it had a real immediate impact on people's lives as opposed to just selling a faster processor chip.
As you come out of school, you've already made that decision. This is what I'm going to do. I've got my degree in hand now, a CIS or MIS degree, and you're going to work for Dell. Did you have a deliberate career path you wanted to take at that point, or were things just still sort of happening?
Oh, yes. I had my complete life planned out yet again. Absolutely. I knew exactly what I was going to do for the rest of my life. And the plan was to be a career-long programmer. I was going to be the best programmer that I could be, and I was going to rise up in the ranks. And I, saw other people who were career-long programmers. Read things from some of the folks who've written books and the magazine articles that I read, and people who were very visible in the industry, and they were 100%. Computer programmers, and they had built their career in there. And so I thought, you know what? I really enjoy doing this. I think I'm going to do the same thing. And, I thought that the compensation was fair and that I could live on that. And so that's what I decided to do.
So that, the description that you just gave about the things you were paying attention to sounds like that impression of being a programmer that many of us have, that I'm going to end up being respected for my gray matter, not necessarily on the business side, but very heavily tech focused. Is that how you saw it at that time? I want to aspire to something with architect at the end of my name, maybe.
Yeah, I did see it as very technical focused. And I even told some people, why would you ever want to supervise and be responsible for the behavior of someone else? I don't understand these people who go into management. That just doesn't make sense to me. I said all those things.
Well, and of course, you know, not to spoil it before we get there too much, but it's ironic, obviously, because now you're chief operating officer at an organization, and that's probably where you spend most of your time.
Definitely.
Was it at Dell where you got your first taste of management, or did that come later?
No, it came later. Well, you know, it came sort of in the middle, because I was at Dell for quite a number of years, then left Dell, a couple of startup companies. When you're in a startup company with just a handful of people, almost everybody is a vice president of something.
All right.
And so, so I was vice president of engineering. But aside from the CEO, my budget was the highest, because I had a team of three people. And so, you know, my payroll was the largest of any department, because the other, you know, quote, VPs didn't actually have any employees. It was just them. So that was my first, management job, was a software startup company.
You kind of glossed over something, and that is that there you are working in this large, very large enterprise organization, and you kind of chucked all that to go try your hand in a startup. And I'm wondering what led to that thinking. Was it good for you? What'd you learn through all that?
Well, working at Dell definitely has given me valuable experiences, and I think at some point, everyone should work for a large, publicly traded, multinational company. Because until you have, there's a whole world out there that you won't understand how it works. Until you've been a part of a really large organization, you won't understand some of the constraints that those people have when running their business.
I thought maybe you were telling me that just because you need to know what frustration feels like.
Well, you know, in any large company, there's going to be some departments that have one culture and other departments that have a completely other culture. And for every person who curses their large employer, you have another person who's praising their large employer. And so for me, during the time at Dell, I think from the different reorgs, probably four different bosses, as, you know, managers came through and they split teams and they merged teams. And that's just the way it goes. So there wasn't just, you know, one continuous flow all the way through. But I have to say one thing. I don't know a whole lot of companies that do this, but, you know, it's a pay cut going from being a programmer to a member of the armed services deployed. And so for the year that I was over in Iraq and Kuwait getting paid less from the Army, Dell compensated me and basically made up the difference from my Army paycheck up to my regular Dell paycheck the entire time that I was out of the country.
Wow, so that is fantastic.
It is fantastic. And I have to mention that, because all kinds of large companies get a bad rap, but that's actually a policy that I really, really enjoyed, and my wife enjoyed as well.
Oh, well, sure. Yeah, that's a really great nugget for Dell. Good for them. Okay, well, at this point, you've now moved into a startup. You've got a couple of reports. You're starting to get a little bit of taste of this management thing. Has your career vision changed at all yet? I mean, you said you were on to stage or round two of that vision. Are you on round three yet?
You know, I didn't have actually a master plan when negotiating that position and talking about that position. It was VP of engineering, and my motivation was to, I think my tactical motivation at the time was to not have a boss who was less competent than I believed that I was. And so I knew that as long as I was an individual contributor, individual programmer, I'd always be in a situation, well, maybe not always, but I would always feel that I was more competent than the person that I was working for. And it was some frustration. And so when I became aware of this new opportunity, part of my thought process was that I'd be able to rectify some of that. And given that it was a small company, I would still be writing code all day. I would still be a programmer. I would just have some extra responsibilities of guiding this team. And so when you only have three direct reports and none of those are managers in and of themselves, you're very much still a hands-on person. You just have some supervisory responsibilities. And so 90% of my day was still as a programmer. And so I didn't see it as a big shift, but I did solve the problem where I was the guy in charge. Some disagreement over technical direction, it was my call to break the tie. And so that was a tactical shift, but as I got into it and as I saw how it was, I thought about it more and more, and I thought about long term, and then I made the conscious decision to shift my focus into being a technical manager at that point.
So one of the things that I remember from my career is that first day where I had direct reports and realizing that things are a bit different now. And I'm wondering if that snuck up on you, or did you realize it all at once that, hey, this other part of my professional life, I'm going to have to pay attention to. It's not just going to happen. I'm going to have to actually be deliberate about getting better as a manager.
I don't think I learned that until maybe 3 years ago. So I went for a period of time without consciously thinking about that, because I thought of myself as a technical manager and I was still squarely focused on improving myself technically, not so much improving my people skills.
Okay.
So that didn't come on day one, although maybe it should have, because I hired the other two people in, but I was hired in above another person who had been with the company since it started, and he really believed that I wouldn't last very long, and so he never accepted me as his boss, and it took a long time to actually earn his trust, so that was a learning experience, because just because you have the authority doesn't mean that you actually have the authority. You know, people still have free will.
Oftentimes, we developers, we look at our boss and think, if this person doesn't have the technical competencies that I do plus some, then my respect for that person is just a little bit less. And maybe this person shouldn't be my manager, right? I hear that a lot. There's no way I can consider this person a legitimate, respected boss of mine because they don't have technical chops. So do you think that that's still, I mean, do you still see that as truth?
That is completely up to the manager. I've seen both situations. On the one side, I've seen a manager who maybe used to be a programmer or thinks they're technical enough. And I actually had one of these at Dell where he didn't know how to program at all. And many of the people on the team felt the same way, that he would come to design and architecture meetings, and he would give his opinion on the design of the system, and it was very clear that he didn't have the experience or the knowledge to be making those decisions, and what he was recommending didn't make sense at all. Of course, the lead architect of the team had enough tact to know how to work through that situation, so that, you know, we basically said, no, that's not a good idea, without screwing up the relationship. And so a manager like that who tries to make decisions beyond his qualifications is, you know, will lose the respect. And so people will think, oh, why is he even over this team? He doesn't understand the things he's trying to do. However, a different manager with the same organizational structure who understands that he doesn't have the skills that other people have, but he has other skills that are valuable to maybe getting things done in the organization. If that manager maybe asks the team and asks the technical people, what's the best design or where should we go? And everyone knows that their feedback is important and the manager knows not to overstep his competence with a P, then I think the situation is just fine. And I mean, it's the same thing with a programmer in a small organization where maybe right next door is the company accountant. Well, if the programmer goes and says, "Oh, I think we should do the accounting this way. Let's accrue this expense differently." Well, there's no qualifications for making those recommendations. And so it's sort of a mismatch. And so the manager really has the choice of how to deal with this team. And when managers sort of talk about issues they don't know and are afraid to say, "I don't know," then they'll lose respect. I mean, even now, there's a lot of things where I have to say, you know, "I don't know about that, but I know exactly who I can go ask."
So I heard that as saying, you know, it's possible to be a good manager in an IT organization, even if I don't have deep technical chops on the domain that my team's working on right now, as long as I'm a servant leader to that group instead of trying to direct the technical decisions.
That's right. You can look at, just to take it to the extreme, a really large company like General Electric has everything from microwaves to jet engines. Do you think that the CEO, Jeffrey Immelt, is going to go in a design session for a new microwave and say anything intelligent?
Right.
Probably not.
Okay. So you obviously navigated this whole world really, really well, and you've done well in your career. As a matter of fact, there was a point just earlier this year I thought was kind of fun, maybe you could speak to, where you ended up on stage with Steve Ballmer at the MVP Summit. How'd that come about?
You know, that's actually a good question, and I don't know exactly how that came about. I received an email from the conference organizer saying that they need someone to do this and asking me if I would be willing to do it. How they came up with my name or how they decided that they would ask me, I really don't have any idea. But I got this email and I replied back and, you know, asked a few follow-up questions. Because it's kind of a big request, you know, what would be expected of me? And I accepted the invitation. But how I was chosen, I really don't know.
Well, I would venture to say it has something to do with the fact that you're known as being someone who bridges these worlds of being a business leader and a technologist at the same time. And so, you know, that's obviously served you very well.
Possibly. I can think of quite a few people who probably would have done a really good job up there. So I'm honored to have that opportunity. It was really fun.
For a lot of us who are on this path that you've been describing to us, maybe we got our first set of reports, we start, or, you know, direct reports, and then we start looking around and thinking, okay, well, what now? It's time for me to take this seriously. What am I going to do with my career? What's my end game goal? A lot of us think chief technical officer, you know, that would be the pinnacle, or chief information officer, whatever the case may be. A lot of other people see a different path. Some organizations even provide separate paths. I'm going to go down this architect with a big A path, right? That's the career path I want to be. Did you ever feel like you had to make that choice?
Yes. Yes, I did. Next question. No, just kidding. I think sometime when I was 14, I aimed high and I said, "I'm going to be the president of the United States." and then, yeah, it's a really lofty goal. And I think I've pulled way back and then started again from the bottom. But every time I hit a goal and hit the next level, I'm always casting the next goal, the next milestone. And so I think for me, at this point, I don't have a lifelong plan like I had a couple of times before, but I have short-term goals, and I know that every time that I hit a short-term goal, I'm just going to cast another one, and it'll be a series of projections. But I did start out at Headspring in 2007 as the chief technical officer, CTO, and over time, actually this past January, I became the chief operating officer, and so I'm very much in the financial statements and operational metrics, labor productivity numbers, efficiency, all kinds of those things, client negotiations, contracts, legal, as well as strategic platform choices and company strategy. And I haven't gotten away from programming because Headspring is a business systems company. Headspring is a software services company. We specialize in helping companies get the most from their business systems. For some, we'll upgrade their system with a new version. For others, we'll create one where they only had a paper process. For others, they have an old legacy system and they can't get the information out of it, or they need some new features, or there's a problem with it. Whatever it is, we help companies get the most out of their business systems to help them run their business. So given the type of company we are, being the chief operating officer still means being a programmer. I don't think that we could have an operations level executive who did not have a background in computer programming because it's sort of the nature of our business. But at this point, my goals are to keep on moving up the executive ladder. Ultimately, you know, just becoming more and more business focused, more focused on strategy, high level technical direction. I'm interested in industry trends, where software is going, what computer languages and tools we'll be using in 10 years. I think a lot about software philosophy at that level, less about individual tools and libraries. I'm currently in school getting my MBA from the Jack Welch Management Institute. And I should finish that up at the end of next year, but definitely on the executive track now.
When you talk to some of the more junior people that might work in your organization or just others that you encounter maybe at conferences and such, are there particular traits, particular behaviors that you notice in people where you think, you know, that person's going to make an impact?
People with passion and drive are always going to accomplish their goals. And people who set goals are going to accomplish them a lot more than people who don't. If you don't set a goal, then you're guaranteed not to hit it. If you don't choose a destination, then any road will do. There are people who learn very purposefully. Like they go to college, they go to a trade school, they get a certification, and now they have met their educational goals, and then they move into their job and move into their careers, and that's one path. Then there are lifelong learners who treated their education and professional certifications or whatever they achieved as steps in the learning process. And they are lifelong learners, always consuming books, always learning from other people, reading articles, getting any information that they can. And to progress, I believe, to progress as far in your chosen field as you can, you need to learn at a faster pace than those around you. And that just means to learn one more thing each day than your peers. Because most people in this world, when they finish their formal education, mentally, they've checked out. Mentally, they've decided, okay, I've gone through my education. Now I've learned what I need to know. Now let's go to work and I'll apply what I know. And then for the next 30 years, they apply what they learned 30 years ago. And of course, they're going to learn little things along the way. But then there's other people who treat it as a lifelong process and are constantly learning and are constantly growing. And those people have just this innate passion to learn and take in more knowledge, and those people are going to achieve whatever goals they set out for.
That was awesome and perfect. One of the things that you mentioned too was metrics that you use. Well, I don't know if you mention the ones that you use yet, but you mentioned that metrics are now a big part of your life. And you and I had a very interesting discussion at some conference one evening in the lobby sort of thing where you described those to me. And they're so fascinating to me. I wonder if you'd be willing to share them here.
Well, in the long and short of it, in my manager capacity, I need some metrics to look at every day. I need some metrics to look at every week, every month, every quarter, and every year. And those numbers should tell me how good my department is doing.
Now, I have to mention, too, though, you're someone who's grown up within those departments. You know what it feels like to be measured, right?
Yes, absolutely. Now, let me just jump right to it. And this is for some people, this is a little uncomfortable, especially for programmers. My department's the largest at Headspring, you know, the operations department, obviously, with all of our billable staff, and then the other department, the other is sales and marketing, and then accounting. And we track time for everyone. Everyone enters their time every day, and everyone is expected to log 8 hours a day. And so to keep the numbers straight, even if you're on vacation, you just log 8 hours to the vacation bucket.
Now, this is because you're a professional services organization, right? That's how you bill your clients.
It is how we bill our clients. But every company pays people to do something. And in the financial world, the term is labor productivity. And you can take the financial statements, you can take the gross profit, you can take your labor expense, and you can divide you can divide the gross profit by your labor expense, and you can basically figure out how many dollars of gross profit do you earn for the company for every dollar in labor expense.
So that's effectively return on investment, no?
Return on labor. Yeah, return on your labor investment.
Right.
Now, the reason we use gross profit is to normalize things out, because obviously a services company is going to have different cost of goods sold than maybe an asset company. For instance, Caterpillar, they have tremendously capital-intensive assets. When Caterpillar sells a piece of machinery, they have a huge portion of it that is cost of goods sold. In other words, it's the cost of the material, the cost of the equipment that they sold. And so that takes you from revenue down to gross profit. Getting down the income statement from gross profit all the way to net income is all about how efficiently you run your organization's facilities and how you organize the labor. So when you start with gross profit, you basically normalize all the industries because you've gotten rid of the anomalies between the cost of selling a tractor and the cost of selling a tomato because the materials are more expensive. And then you can basically take gross profit, compare it with your labor expense, and see how much gross profit you're earning per dollar of labor. And for every business, there's a threshold that you can't go below. Otherwise, you're just losing money. And so I think that it's important for every business to understand where their labor is going. And but especially in a services business where our product is a unit of time. We bill by the hour. So essentially, as part of our billing system, we need to know where we're spending those hours so that we can track those all the way through an invoice and then back to the bank statement. But the best description I can say of our business, as far as our operating model, is we have inventory that goes bad. That inventory is a person hour. For instance, if we were a fish market, we would go to the coast and we would buy fresh fish every morning. And we would buy in units of eight, you know, for 8 hours a day. Units of eight fish, we would buy these buckets of fish. And whatever fish we couldn't sell that day, well, it was just lost. It went bad because the fish, you know, fish don't keep from one day to the next if you're in the fresh fish business. You know, you can freeze a fish overnight, but, you know, the inventory goes bad. You can't keep a person's hour from one day to the next. So whatever we don't sell in a day, goes bad. And so it's all about efficiency. And in order to track that, we need to know where every hour from every person is going, even sales and marketing.
So how do you do that?
We found, after a long search, we found a time tracking tool called Easy Time Tracker from Logic Software. It's a little Windows app that has a very good data entry UI where we can enter all of our clients. We can keep track of the hourly rates, the different projects we have for each client, the different tasks and deliverables within each project. And then every employee has an account, and it basically saves the data into a SQL Server database. So that's the transactional system. And then we created a dashboard where in a different SQL Server database, every 10 minutes, we just suck the data and do a transform into a different schema. And we've created a star schema, which is part of OLAP. That's another topic, but we created a star schema, and our most prominent fact table is basically dimensions by client, project, day, month, year, quarter, lots of other dimensions to group by. And then every row is a single time entry, because for every row, we want to be able to report on facts such as revenue earned for that time entry, margin for that time entry, how much of that time entry was billable time, how much was unbillable time, what that was for, what level of staff was it, and so.
Now, this dashboard that you described to me earlier, though, where you aggregate those things you're talking about, it sounded like you were sort of monitoring in real time the profitability of each and every project.
We don't have the profitability to the cent because it's not an accounting system, but we get pretty darn close. And so I actually wrote a blog post where I show some screenshots of some of these trends. And so I don't have the URL with me right now, but if you go to the blog post, I think it's the second or third one down. It's titled Growing a Professional Services Company, My Experience, Critical Drivers, Metrics, and Business Intelligence. That's a long title.
We'll have it in the show notes.
Right. But essentially there's some of the graphs of the trends, and we've determined that if we were to make a cockpit for ourselves, you know, a dashboard in an airplane inside the cockpit, what are the really big and obvious dials that would tell us if the plane is operating in a safe manner or if it's about to hit the ground, right? So when you think about a dashboard, you have to decide what dials are going to give you the information necessary at a glance to know that everything is going okay. And so the first big dial for us is our time allocation. In other words, what percentage of our time are we billing versus going to staff meetings or company offsites or spending on sales or unbilled time for clients for various reasons, or just flex time or continuous improvement time for employees? What percentage? Because in the end, if the build time percentage is going down and down and down and down, that has a direct correlation with company revenue, which would be going down and down and down. So at a glance, looking at that trend line, we can see how that's going. The other big dial that we have is what are our hourly rates? Because if the hourly rates are stable, then it's all about time allocation. If hourly rates over time are going up or down, then something is changing that we need to be aware of. But if everything's okay, that's stable. And then the third one is about company structure. What percentage of the company is operations billable staff versus unbilled staff? Because the billable staff obviously needs to earn enough money for the unbilled staff as well. So over time, we can monitor the structure of our company because a certain percentage of bill time 6 months ago might not be enough now if we've hired more unbillable staff and the percentages are a little bit off.
So I actually just pulled up the blog post so that I could look at the visuals that you were talking about as you talked through them. And they make a lot more sense to see a picture. So other people listening to the show might want to do that too. I could see, though, how you've just described an environment that would make a lot of developers tremble in fear, frankly, because you really do know the real-time balance sheet, or at least near real-time. And I think the next question becomes, okay, what do you do with that? Because, you know, if you're somebody who only dabbles in the stock market, you tend to watch that stock all the time and you'll sell when you're a nickel over, right? So that's a pretty bad micromanaging behavior. And I'm wondering, well, you've got this data here that would enable you to do that sort of thing. What do you do with this?
When we started tracking time, we had a conversation with everyone, and there were some folks who were uneasy because they had been in some environments before where time was tracked and management did stupid things with that data, honestly. And we made a commitment to all of the employees that said, look, we need this information in order to run the company effectively. But we promise you that we are not going to use this data to do stupid things. We promise you that we are going to use this data to help run a healthier company. And we shared that that was the motivation. We don't care about anything except keeping the company healthy. And so every decision around this was through a shared motivation for everyone to have a healthy company. Because, and by the way, within the company, every employee knows the salary of every other employee.
Oh, interesting.
And every month, we have a financial briefing for everyone where we share the finances, even down to how many dollars and cents is in the operating bank account. So we have a level of transparency where it just doesn't pay to have any secrets, because by sharing the information, everyone can understand the motivation and the rationale for some decisions. And everything is about keeping a company healthy, because without a healthy company, the paychecks don't keep flowing into each individual programmer's bank account at home.
So the more open you are with everybody who has to put their time in about why you're asking them to do this, you find that the negative feelings about it go away?
You know, we didn't have a whole lot of negative feelings. There was just some in the early days of this time tracking, some apprehension of they didn't know. But, you know, I guess today, we've had some conversations. Some people have made the comments that said, wow, this really worked out well. I was a little bit uneasy at first, but it is absolutely, everyone unanimously agrees, this has absolutely been a good thing for the company. So there's really no question right now.
You mentioned always having your eye on the next thing. One of the things that I have heard you recently talk about is the notion of zero surprise software development. That's a specialty for you guys. And I wonder if you could speak to what that means and how you're chasing that idea of zero surprise development.
Well, that's an internal goal of ours, to never surprise our client. For instance, if they get an invoice before they're expecting it, that's a surprise. If they get an invoice and it's a different number than what they're expecting, it's a surprise. If there's a bug in the software, that's a surprise. If the software is missing a feature, that's a surprise. If it crashes, it's a surprise. If we go over budget, it's a surprise. If we miss a date, it's a surprise. And obviously, if a project fails, it's a surprise. And so I've done a lot of thinking with Kevin Hurwitz, our chief architect, and what does it take to offer a no surprises experience for a client? And it goes all the way back to putting an effective project plan in place to see if what they're asking for is actually feasible. And that's led us to a couple of really big ideas. The first is design to cost. And this is not a new idea. In the housing industry, it goes all the time. If you go up to a real estate broker and say, I need a house, can you give me an estimate? That's not the way it works. You go and say, I need a house, and they ask you some questions, and you end up saying, okay, I want a 4-bedroom house. And then the next question is, what's your budget? Because honestly, you can get a 4-bedroom house as cheap as you need it to be. I've seen 4-bedroom houses that are $50,000, and I've seen 4-bedroom houses that are $10 million. So, you know, it's the same thing with software. You can accomplish the same objective in business automation for very different budgets. And so the first is feasibility and what are we going to accomplish for a given budget, and being open and honest with a customer. We just got finished telling a customer no, that, you know what, we really can't accomplish the thing that you're talking about for this budget. And then we talk about what we could accomplish. Because if you go into that situation expecting something to magically change, then you're guaranteed the client's going to be surprised. So it happens at the start. And the second is open and honest communication with the client the whole way through. And this has nothing to do with how you write lines of code. But the problem with estimation is that it's not updated when it should. If we give an estimate, the second we believe that we have more information and the estimate has changed, but we don't tell the client, well, now there's a mismatch and we're guaranteed to have a client surprise. And so, you know, we track our estimates all the way through. And when we're 20% through, we say, okay, is this still the estimate? Have we learned anything new? And we found that in the cases where we really did give a wrong estimate at the beginning, as long as we communicate to the customer that we've learned something new and give them a new estimate before we've spent all their money, then it's usually an easy conversation to decide what to do. They may choose to change direction, we may choose to increase the budget, or modify some things. But either way, if you wait until you're 80 or 90% through spending the money for that budget before you tell them that you actually aren't going to meet that, it's never a happy conversation.
Sure.
And it always gets back to, is the client surprised?
Well, Jeffrey, thank you so much for being on the show. It was an absolute pleasure, and hopefully we'll get to do this again sometime.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
Well, this has been a great episode, and I want to thank you, the listener, for the absolute pleasure of a lifetime being the host of the Pluralcast. And I just want to thank Pluralsight for this opportunity. It's been absolutely wonderful. Now, as always, we want to thank our musical contributors, to include Patrick Lee of patrickleemusic.com and the Judies at wastedtalentrecords.com. This has been your host, David Starr, and folks, I look forward to seeing you in class sometime soon.
Only time.